You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Jenny Jalander, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you are the creator of Thing Testing. People might know it if they've been to your Instagram, which is just Thing Testing. And I'll try to describe it, but I would love to hear a little bit from your perspective. It's a Instagram-based review compendium of mostly brands in the direct-to-consumer space. A lot of folks that have been on the podcast have also been featured on your Instagram. And you take pictures and write a review of these products from your perspective. And it's beautifully curated, and you've really put together a pretty vibrant community on Instagram, which is not an easy thing to do. Is that fair, or what else would you add to the description of Thing Testing these days?
That's a perfect description, I think, Stefan. Well done. I think the only small thing to add is probably that the reviews are written from two perspectives. So there's the kind of from me version of how I see the products and how the user experience of those products were. And then there's a VC section where I more so give a perspective of the company and the industry landscape and the market. But that was a perfect way to describe it.
And so you are based in London. You're originally Finnish / Swedish. Give us a little bit of a background on how you arrived at Thing Testing and why this VC side is important to what you're doing.
Sure. So yeah, I'm from Helsinki, Finland, and my dad is Swedish, so I speak both Swedish and Finnish at home. I always thought I was going to work in fashion during my uni years. And so I did internships at H&M and worked as a sales clerk next to my study years. Actually even dropped out from uni to do a visual merchandising degree, which is a degree where you learn how to kind of make shopping windows. And it was fascinating dropout because one of the teachers, I remember very vividly him saying that, okay, here's these 15 girls and retail's dying, so we got to teach them Photoshop and InDesign. And that came in very handy later now that I'm doing Thing Testing. But anyways, that was a small sidetrack. I did that degree, ended up then realizing that fashion really wasn't for me, especially not the fast fashion world, and that the visual side and the branding side was more interesting. So I worked at a design agency, and as a producer, I was very familiar with the packaging world through that. So we share that passion, Stefan. I worked there and worked with brands, everything from rebranding, then startups, etc. And this was, by the way, also all next to studying. We have a different system back in Nordics where people get a lot of part-time job done during their studies. But I saw this startup event emerge on campus that was just a couple of thousand people gathering, mainly from the kind of gaming ecosystem, which is big in the Nordics, having King and Candy Crush and Angry Birds and stuff like that on campus. And I saw this startup event emerging, people started to fly in from abroad to go to this student-run event. And I also realized that they didn't have any Instagram and no Twitter accounts, nothing up and running. So I sent them a cold call and said, look, guys, I can be your official Instagrammer. And that volunteer gig then became 3.5 years where I worked at Slush, and I ran our brand and marketing, and we grew that conference to a 20K conference that it is today. So that was an absolutely amazing...
I don't know if people know what Slush is in the US, but it seems to be... I haven't been myself, but it seems to be one of the biggest tech events happening in Europe.
It's definitely one of... There's Web Summit, which is by headcount larger, but Slush, I think, is definitely one of those leading ones. And it's known very much for its, like, how we put it together. So partly how it looks and feels is a little bit like lasers and this whole like atmosphere around it, but also it's student run or volunteer run. So we were five people in the beginning of the year setting it up, but we were 2,500 volunteers in the end of the year. So doing that a couple of times, it was really an amazing learning exercise for me. I did that, and I'm trying to to come to the full story of how thing testing then started. It's a long one, I'm sorry. I actually, the last weeks at Slush, when I realized I really need to go back and finish my studies soon, I had a call with a VC who said, hey, Jenny, we need some help with marketing. And I was really confused because to me, VCs were especially in this time, and it was 2015, so now I think VCs do a lot more marketing, but I hadn't seen very many VCs do anything interesting in that space, so I was quite, surprised and also didn't really understand, because from my point of view back then, VCs wouldn't have to do any marketing, kind of startups would line up in front of them and pitch and et cetera. So I decided that this topic after a while was quite interesting and wrote my master thesis in 130 very dry pages, which people can find online on venture capital firm branding. And one of those interviews was with Backed VC, where I ended up working. So that's where the kind of VC lens to the post. I finally came to the full circle of how you started this question. But yeah, that's kind of where the VC angle of the reviews also come in.
So when you look at the products that you're reviewing, what is the VC angle on those products? How do you, because you mentioned early on you have your sort of user mindset. What does the VC mindset look like?
Yeah, I think the short answer to that is probably how that product works on scale, right? So is there enough people who would agree with my micro perspective, and what's the trends in that space, competitors, but also things like, you know, frequency of using that product. Does it make sense from that perspective? At my job at Backed, I usually look at VC from a lens where there's three steps to the whole process, and one is sourcing the companies that we fund, and one is selecting which ones to fund, and the third one is to support those companies after funding. So I was the first employee at Backed, and I had this non-title of community or head of special projects or whatever, but I definitely worked more on the sourcing side and the supporting side. So I think testing has very much for me been a platform to learn, and specifically the direct consumer space, which I thought was really fascinating with my branding background to look closer at. So I definitely see think testing, by the way, as a big learning platform to me. Yeah.
I think a lot of VCs over the past few years have started to delve more into content, and some of the big ones that are well known, like Andreessen Horowitz or First Round, have like a lot of blog posts going on or have delved into podcasts, but I haven't seen any who are on Instagram. And I think what I really appreciate about your point of view here is that it starts with the user experience. So, you know, I think a lot of investment conversation happens at a more abstract level, which is, you know, what would be the total size of the market, or, you know, some of, like you said, competitors or that kind of stuff. But the way that you're approaching it through think testing is it starts with the product. Like, is this a good experience? What's interesting about this? How it's made? That kind of stuff. And I think that is much more what ultimately will make the company successful, hopefully. It's what people are using and if they like it.
I 100% agree. It also, you know, makes the audience on think testing quite interesting, because not everyone is that interested in the kind of the bigger lens. Some people,
right,
I know,
they're
follow it
curious,
actually just for discovery of new brands. And I think that audience is very much growing right now on think testing itself. So there's a bunch of people. I actually receive comments almost on a or DMs on a daily basis now, people asking me what VC stands for. So that means that, you know, this discovery of the new brands is definitely that's a large audience, which makes me really excited.
Well, it's an actual problem, and it's something that we've talked about on the podcast a few times recently on the episode with Paul Mumford of LeanLux, where we have so many brands who are building their own website, doing a direct to consumer approach. And it becomes difficult to have discovery around those products, because they're actively trying to not sell through Amazon or other platforms. So something like think testing has a real purpose in terms of just helping people find things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you say that. It's definitely an interesting mix of people. And I'm very grateful for the people who found Think Testing Hunter Walk being one of the very, very early ones. I mean, it was basically just in the beginning, it was just me and a couple of hundreds of people for many, many months, you know, commenting and discussing the products that were up there. And then Hunter Walk's article brought in a lot of VCs and the kind of tech crowd. But after that, there's been articles in all different kinds of medias, and you always see different feedback or comments coming in when they are, depending on if it's kind of a tech crowd or the DNVB crowd coming into the account, etc. So that I find incredibly exciting that it can help so many people. And I just had a dinner a couple of days ago with a lot of the founders that had been on Think Testing here on the European side of the pond. And two of the founders actually told me that they've hired people through Think Testing now. So that's incredibly exciting too, that some people are using it not only for the discovery side, but also I guess it buys into this whole trend of millennials not only buying products that have a specific value, but also want to work for those type of companies. So two founders told me that they've had people at interviews saying that they applied because they found it on Think Testing. So that's unbelievable to me. But
well, Hunter Walk and Satya Patel, his partner, were basically the first investors in Lumi. So they're like, they can find things. I don't know how they find things, but they've got sources coming to them from all different ways. But so what was it that inspired you to even start this thing? Like in the very beginning, when you were just posting your first few reviews before it kind of blew up, were you just doing it for yourself, or what was your hope going into it?
I definitely never expected what it is today. I mean, I after that master thesis and my interview with Bakkt for the thesis, I started working for Bakkt here in London then, and I had the list of startups that I couldn't wait to try. Like, it's unbelievable probably for a lot of people, but I hadn't tried Amazon Prime even a year and a half ago. So like, I had this list of stuff that I'd been tweeting about and hearing all these founders talk about at Slush, and then finally moving to like a big city that had these services was a dream for someone like me. So I had this list, started trying out these products, and I think it was in November a year ago that I went to the Glossier pop-up shop in London, and I was just pretty mind-blown. I mean, like, there was a red carpet, and there was these iPads and boiler suits, and like, it didn't look like a store. It was in an apartment on the second floor, and people were lining up to get in, and I was so confused about this whole thing, and there, you know, experience after experience, I was really, like, impressed by a lot of the stuff I saw and tested to an extent where, like, when I spoke with friends back home who were asking how the move to London had gone, etc., I didn't even mention how stuff was with me. I was just talking about all these brands. So I needed a channel. That was like the first thing. And the second thing, as I said, it was for me very much a learning perspective. So yeah, also a year and a half ago, I didn't know the word direct to consumer or DNVB. It's all new to me. So it became this way for me to just, you know, channel out my thoughts, have this lens from a user point of view and a VC point of view, and learn on the way. That was as simple as it sounds. It was buying those two foam boards that I shoot the products on in my living room, thanks to those Photoshop skills from the visual merchandising degree way back. And yeah, that was it. It was very, very simple. However, I guess like a couple of months ago, I realized the account grew to 20,000 followers, and I started to have a lot of emails in my Think Testing inbox about all these incredible things that potentially the account could become, and added features like websites and newsletter, etc. And it became something that I couldn't just do in the evenings and weekends. So I'm actually since a couple of weeks back on a little sabbatical to just be able to focus on Think Testing for a short time, full time, and you know, just see what it potentially then could become, or at least to test things out. So so that's what it is today also.
I have some really basic questions about how you do this, but are you able to get all of these products delivered to London, or do you have to do some crazy things to like actually get some of these products, or do they all ship all the way to
Europe? No, they don't. I mean, especially the US ones, which is, I mean, I'm so intrigued by this. A lot of the European and a couple of Australian brands that I've tried now, they ship globally from day one, whereas the US products stay in US for a long, long time. Anyway, so the ones that ship to US only, I have to ask. I DM them and try all different channels to get to them, and then eventually they answer and send me a product that I can test. But most of the products that ship to the US, I have also paid for. So yeah, they do ship.
What proportion of them do you find ship to Europe?
From the US ones,
it's
actually fewer than you'd think, right? And that's another thing that people are not only asking what VC stands for. That's probably the second most asked question is,
can I get this?
Yeah, thing? When are they shipping to Europe or this country or this country? So there would definitely be someone should think about the distribution on a global scale for a lot of these direct consumer companies at all as well.
Well, when I was running my previous company, we started off like day one shipping to every country, and you can do that with the U.S. Postal Service. But the problem is that things really frequently get stuck at customs,
right?
And every country is different. And the problem is, if you really want to offer cheap shipping to customers, you can use the USPS, and they have like a first class international mail that's pretty cheap. It's like, you know, $10 to $15 or something like that to send to almost any country. But you have no tracking and no idea if it gets stuck in customs, and it can take like 4 weeks or sometimes months to get to you. If you want the actual tracking internationally, it's going to cost like $30 or more just for shipping. And that is a huge barrier for most people. So that, I think that's the main problem. And then the second one is that, and that's something we can talk about with relation to Europe, is that they don't necessarily need to go to other countries immediately, because there's so many English-speaking people within the U.S. market that they can start off selling to. So I think that's what tends to happen. But I agree with you. It's an interesting problem that I think could be solved. And we're seeing some brands like expand to Europe in a more intentional way. You mentioned Glossier, but I'm just curious from your perspective how that experience feels, or if the people in Europe are aware of these brands at all, or if the European market is completely different.
It's a great question. I mean, overall, I think direct to consumer is quite a few years ahead in US, to an extent where, you know, people talk a lot about that there's a lot more funding and a lot more, you know, talent, and you have success stories in the US, which is all very, very true. The other thing is also that people understand, I think, on a more general level, I think just terminology like cutting out the middleman is a thing that, you know, you see all these stores, especially in the metropolitan cities in the US, and it's just, it's become like, I think, words that, you know, the general public kind of,
they understand the business behind it.
Exactly, the business model of it, right? Whereas mm-hmm. in Europe, when you don't have as many success cases, it's just a very different kind of scale. But that's just, you know, one level of obviously the funding and that side is definitely on a different level in the US. And also on Europe's defense, I think, however, we talked about this a little bit before also, before the podcast started recording, but Europe has an amazing talent pool that all these heritage brands like Chanel and etc. made in Italy, made in France, you know, the big companies.
Yeah.
That, you know, if somebody would kind of put this talent pool together with all that capital and kind of success stories and cases from the US, I think there's an incredible potential in US, in Europe as well to create massive direct to consumer brands too. And we see them coming, right? There's companies like in France, for example, Cezanne, and now recently launched all the kind of Hims versions, so Manuel and Many and etc. And organic basics and clothing, I think, is a big one in Europe at the moment. But yeah, I'm very, very excited to see how that kind of unfolds.
Well, I think what you're saying about the manufacturing industry in Europe and the talent around fashion and certain products is totally valid. And we've had many companies on the podcast who've mentioned that their products are directly sourced from Italy. I think Greats, Ryan Babazine from Greats mentioned that all their shoes are made in Italy. We had a razor company who makes their, you know, blades in Germany. We have companies who are making all kinds of products in Europe are, and those countries have a wealth of expertise that goes back sometimes thousands of years in certain crafts. And so the American entrepreneurs are going there to source products and source that expertise. It's just, it's curious that we're not seeing as much of that in Europe. And I don't know if that's a cultural thing, like people maybe have more respect for those heritage brands like you described them. They like the fact that it's something that's been around for 100 years and are maybe less likely to trust a newer brand. I don't know if that if that's one factor or if it's a language barrier factor that, you know, here in the US you can pretty quickly grow a brand and only have to localize in English. But if you're in Europe, you have to, if you want to really grow, you have to have a version of your website in 4 or 5 or 6 different languages.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's actually a small city I learned in southern Spain, I think it's called Ubrik, that does, this is to the manufacturing point, but does basically all the leather goods for our direct-to-consumer company. So Everlane, et cetera, they all have this same little village in the southern Spain,
right,
that is behind most of the leather goods in the whole industry. So it's
Parachute, I think, was made in Portugal, a lot of their sheets and stuff. So yeah, there's a ton of stuff like that.
Yeah. Definitely. No, but, you know, overall, I'm not saying that everyone should start in all countries at the same time. That should be something that people, you know, spend a lot more time on thinking what their strategy is. But I think overall, thinking about these brands as not just direct to consumer and keeping it to a specific channels. And it seems like in the US, there's a very much a playbook to how to kind of build a direct to consumer brand and what the right ways for that is. Whereas in Europe, or specifically a company I chatted with last week from Australia, we had this chat about, like, look, when your market isn't big enough for to do the kind of US version of the playbook, you start to operate with a bunch of different channels and you try all different things with partnerships and wholesale and retail, etc. I think on a lot earlier, because you have to. So that's interesting, especially if you think about, I think every single direct-to-consumer company is something. It's a word that we use, direct-to-consumer, right now because it's a new thing. But I think that in a couple of years' time, we will all just be calling them brands. They've just started and they're growing in a different way than potentially brands previously were. So all different channels and wholesale and retail will be relevant to all of these brands at some point. That's just my take on it. Might be controversial, but
well, no, I don't think it's controversial, and it's something to explore. I mean, I do think they are all brands, but a company like Colgate, for example, doesn't sell direct at all. You can't get your toothpaste from Colgate.com. You can only get it through stores or through Amazon or through, you know, in the US, Walmart or Target or those types of places. And I think that is a pretty significant difference, because I think it's going to be hard for a company like Colgate to actually develop that direct-to-consumer model at all. The only way they might be able to do it is either by, you know, acquiring existing brands or developing brand new separate entities to do that, just because their relationships with these big retailers are so strictly controlled and so important to them and move so much volume of their product. So that maybe is where the difference is.
Also, you know, we have this discussion a lot with brands that are suddenly doing a lot of retail or trying pop-ups or going offline. And, you know, for me, it's just a signal of, like, eventually most brands will also try to become what the traditional brands were. Just the fact that they have that initial relationship with the customers is obviously, like, an incredible superpower to have then later on as well. I went to this talk with way back at South by Southwest, I think, where Eric Ries said startups very often kind of shy away from corporations, and that there's this divide of, you know, like, trying not to be a corporation. But ultimately, we're every single startup is trying to become a corporation. Maybe there's just something from that world to, you know, also take to the direct-to-consumer space where there isn't really that divide between the traditional brands and the new modern brands is potentially not as deep as we imagine.
Well, yeah, every big company wants to feel like a small company, and every small company wants to feel like a big company. But actually, when you were talking about the playbook that kind of has developed, at least in the U.S., I think one of the criticisms that has come up, over the past couple of years is just that everything is looking kind of similar, that there's a lot of brands that, you know, they're just doing that same thing in a new vertical. From your experience kind of doing these reviews and being a user of these products, do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I think a lot of them, you know, use the same colors and fonts and things like that. But you also see that outside of the direct-to-consumer space. You see that with, you know, new insurance companies or startups overall kind of launching right now. So I think it's actually like, you know, back in the days, apparently Comic Sans was very popular. So that signaled something about that. And, you know, for Instagram specifically, I think with thing testing, pastel colors and that kind of contrast, it works in that format. And it's something that, you know, signals something, I think, a lot bigger than just the direct-to-consumer space. But yeah, I agree with you. It's probably part of the playbook too, you know. I know Webb Smith and Paul Mumford talk about this, like, blending trend or have mentioned in their newsletters. And, you know, I've recently discovered that these brands even use the same law firms, you know. So, you know, it feels like, you know, you ask your friend who launched a similar company, who did you use, and the branding agencies and the law firms, etc. It's kind of part of that whole playbook as well. So yeah, definitely, I think there's a lot of interesting things to be explored in, like, you know, broadening that sense, and also then to just look different, right?
Do you find that to be a problem from your perspective, either as a VC or as a user?
The bigger problem is, I think, when it's just been a branding process or a visual identity that's been set up before identifying your brand's values, or like a more deeper level of what you actually stand for and what you're trying to build. So, you know, if it sounds and looks very great, but then what's the actual kind of change you're making or trying to communicate through your company? That, I think, is maybe a little bit more. I don't like that.
But the values and like kind of mission behind the company is something that you do tend to emphasize quite a bit in your reviews. Is that something that's important to you, or how do you think about that? Or is it your response to what consumers are asking to, or something like that?
I think it's definitely something that direct-to-consumer companies should be thinking about a lot, because otherwise, if it's just a convenience product, or if you're not trying to kind of build this community around your brand, then Amazon is a lot bigger threat for you than if you have a specific vision and values and this bigger thing you're trying to build through your company. And yeah, we see the world going in this either convenience through Amazon or strong brands and communities that are kind of differentiating themselves from that. So I think that's super, super important to think about as a direct-to-consumer brand, be it, you know, the classic examples of Glossier or Away or Allbirds. But I do think these guys have, the until now successful cases in this category, have managed to do that quite well. So I'd strongly recommend the younger brands to also think about that. I emphasize a lot of sustainability in my products, just because it's something that and especially in the kind of me part of the review, because it's something that is important to me. I'm not saying that every single person should be thinking, or I actually am, but yeah, I don't think everyone is, but it's something that I'm very passionate about. So that shines through. Like most things on think testing is still just my voice, right? It's nothing bigger than that. So that, I guess, shines through. And also now with female founders, and just yesterday was International Women's Day. It's something that I like to highlight when I can.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, how do you balance kind of highlighting the positives versus the negatives of your experience with a product and those types of ideas? Like, are they going far enough into sustainability or into the values of the company? Do you find yourself trying to take a more optimistic viewpoint on the products, or are there products, because you're not posting anything that you don't really like, right? You're only posting the highlights or the best things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my curation aspect goes as far to, I try a lot. I actually counted yesterday. Right now, I am testing 18 products, and I think that potentially 5 of them will make it to reviews, because in a weird way, I want to keep it positive. Like, I don't like, yeah. you know, in the same way as no magazine or newspaper writes negative very, very negative restaurant reviews. Maybe they do, but like, I like to have a positive feed. I don't think there's really a need to have a lot more negativity in the world. So I try to highlight the ones I really, really like, but also if there's just a small aspect, let's say, you know, I thought there were too much packaging or the size went down when you washed, whatever, I highlight those things also in the companies that I overall liked. So yeah, that's definitely like the curation aspect. I think specifically like beauty products and things like that, it takes a long time to test them. So that's why there's so many kind of products that I'm actually right now using, because you can't really see the results from many of them if you don't use them for long enough. And then I think it's interesting also because I'm not being paid by any of the brands, right? So there's no revenue on that side and no partnerships, etc. I think it's important that, you know, also if I for example, repurchase the product, I think that's an interesting thing to know from a customer point of view, that it was actually so good that I bought a second one from them. So,
are you familiar with Wirecutter? Do you know Wirecutter?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I wonder if we're going to get to a point where there are so many competitors in the space that something like that is, you know, necessary. And I know that in the mattress world, there have been, you know, websites that kind of focused on understanding the differences between all the different ones. But, you know, Wirecutter does a great job when it comes to consumer products of doing testing that is like more comparative in nature, whereas yours seem to be more like personal, I guess.
You know, I'd love to, by the way, I love Wirecutter. I think they're doing a great job. Also, the strategist that New York Magazine is doing a great job of writing product reviews. Wirecutter maybe goes a little bit in depth into the testing process, whereas as strategist is more about recommendations. I think, you know, what I'd love to do with thing testing next is to get other people to also review, so that it wouldn't be just my opinions, and that I could maybe crowdsource opinions from the follower base and things like that. So that would expand the whole product portfolio a lot for me too, because obviously now there's a bunch of guys' products that aren't being tested, and parents that have opinions on a huge category, like everything related to that. So I'd love to, you know, expand the reviews to include also other people's opinions and be less just about me. But right now it's what it is.
And where do you think thing testing is going to go next? Is it, I mean, I know that it's something that people are asking you, but just in the realm of reviews, there's so many more products to review. You've started doing a newsletter. You started doing a website. Like, what are the next things for you in terms of where you want to see it grow?
Thanks for asking such a small question, Stefan. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Just the next few months, maybe. We don't have to talk about the future of the universe.
No, it always feels also bigger to me than what it is for anyone else. Anyways, I think, you know, a plan is always a plan for me. Things tend to always then change after a couple of days when you realize something else is coming up. But what I do a lot now is just listen to what A, followers are saying, and then B, what founders that have been featured on the account are saying. So on the follower side, I think people are definitely like looking for ease in the whole discovery process. So be it just like making a website with a little bit more search function, etc., is probably something that I think I can pull off. And on the founder side, you know, there's the, as I said, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, but I think talent is a big, big like pain point for also in the direct to consumer space, and just even launching a tiny jobs board or whatever around that is definitely something that I want to do next. But long term, you know, it's hard for me. I said I would love to have other people on board, and I'd love to see all these different channels and things around thing testing, but one thing at a time. And I think for me definitely is the focus on discovery and the ease of that, so not having people scroll through old posts on the Instagram, but maybe on a website, etc.
Well, one of the things that is really amazing about your presence on Instagram is that you have a lot of engagement. Just in my experience from, you know, poking around Instagram and helping with the Lumi Instagram, it's really hard to actually get the level of community building that you have on thing testing. Just because Instagram like will very aggressively, you know, filter you out if your post isn't getting very much traction. And so I'm just curious, like, is there anything that you've done to foster that community or to help people be more engaged?
So thing testing is quite scrappy, right? I mean, it's still just those foam boards and...
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'm not a Photoshop genius. Like, it's not nothing like huge production, nothing in it. And I think people like scrappy. There's something around that just makes it maybe relatable and authentic. And it's a low barrier to kind of comment and have an own opinion when it's when it is that. So it's something I struggle with. I'm like, should I forever keep on editing these photos, or should I get some help maybe from someone who's actually an expert doing it? Just because I think the scrappiness is something a lot of, you know, brands kind of lose when they grow. So that's a big challenge for me. I kind of don't know how to keep that as thing testing grows. But I would say that that's a thing that makes people engage. Overall, I think, like, I see community as something, you know, way back in time we all went to villages and we chatted with each other and that was your community. And now we form those communities online, and Instagram being one. And again, as we spoke earlier about these, be it sustainability values or other type of values that I emphasize quite a lot, that brings people together. So that becomes your kind of village online. So I think a lot of people are engaging with the content, because both in positive and negative ways, by the way. So a lot of people now kind of associate thing testing with maybe someone who looks at the sustainability lens on things in this space. And then I get a lot of comments like, hey, I think this product had way too much, you know, plastic. Oh, yeah. Or something. So, yeah. So then that becomes the engagement. But again, as we said, I think if you're very clear about your values, which I, by the way, don't think I've written explicitly anywhere, like on my website or anything, but it kind of comes through, that becomes the community and the low barrier to kind of engage in the conversation. Yeah.
What you said about scrappiness really resonates with me also, because when we started doing videos for Lumi, our budget for a video was like $50. Like, so we made everything out of cardboard. We had no special effects or anything. And we just tried to make it fun and entertaining. But over time, you know, we can afford to have like a slightly higher budget, but we still try to like do it for $100 or $50 of just random cardboard and DIY stuff. And I think that's something that I do agree that companies, even small companies, tend to overthink a lot. They feel like they need like a high production value thing that's going to look amazing. But the real thing that makes it engaging is the creativity. And like in your case, you're writing a whole, you know, bunch of text in the Instagram that comes from you and is very authentic. And people
respond. It's filled with typos, you mean?
It's filled with typos. Yeah. You know, that they can tell it's written by a real human being. Yeah. And when you go to YouTube, for example, like a lot of the biggest YouTubers who get millions and millions of views, it's not Coca-Cola or something. It's like, it's just individual people who are doing something in their bedroom. And I think people resonate with that because they know that it's real and it's not necessarily trying to sell them something or trying to, I don't know, convince them of anything. It's a interaction with another person.
And people love to be part of that journey early on, I think. So it's something that, you know, you hear a lot. Like, I was a very early follower of things. Like, it resonates with people to be early on board, because then they're part of the whole journey and it feels even more like authentic and relatable. So yeah, definitely. I wonder like how far you can take the scrappiness. At Slush, I remember it was something that we, you know, because that's also a similar, you know, volunteers running, very low budget, kind of probably where I got my whole resourcefulness from, but you didn't really have any budgets or anything. And I think people loved the fact that, you know, chairs were a little bit here and there. And because the most important part of it, again, was that it was volunteer-run and people knew that we aren't charging startups very much and all these different things. So if it's directly impacting your main value, which in the Slush case at least was the whole, you know, community running it. And in maybe Think Testing's case, maybe it is a VC that usually wasn't on Instagram and then doing it in her li- like there's a weirdness to it, I guess. Then that works, right? So
yeah. When you think about that aspect of sustainability and sort of the values that you've brought to it, and you've got the community responding to that, sort of saying, I think this product is not as sustainable as this other one. We actually get some of that feedback too now on YouTube, because we've been doing a series called Unboxing Things, which is sort of like similar and other, but similar, but different, because Jessie is her own character. And we get those types of, that type of feedback too. And how do you deal with that? How do you think about responding to that, or do you take it into account in any way?
So I think, you know, the simple answer to all of those questions is, right, that not consuming anything is the most sustainable option of them all. And that is definitely, of course, very, very true. What I kind of see my responsibility as the, it's not a big account, but there's more followers than there were in the beginning, is that I'm doing the testing on behalf of others. So I kind of take that lens to the sustainability arguments, and I do see more and more companies DMing me now, asking, you know, where did this company get this foam board from or this packaging from, and then I can kind of be a little bit of a, give the information to the next companies to do good. So I think people, as we spoke earlier about the playbook, they also look at the sustainability aspect when it comes to this whole playbook as well. Do people, by the way, ask you guys more recently about a lot more sustainable packaging, or how's that? Is that a trend that you're seeing?
Definitely, yes. It has changed over the past 2 or 3 years, where it's only growing, and there's innovations happening in the packaging space. We're doing a bunch of things. We're going to have like a lot of exciting stuff to announce later this year on that. But yeah, it's absolutely important. But I also agree with you that it starts with the consumer behavior. Like, packaging is the step after you've already made a decision to purchase something in the first place. So with what I'm doing here with Well Made, and you know, our general goals as a company, we want to try and shift consumer behavior to be less wasteful in the first place. And I think some of these brands are positioned really well to be able to drive that narrative of, you know, we had Porter Road, who's an interesting online butcher shop, on the podcast recently. And they're a butcher shop who says, like, you should eat less meat. You should eat better quality meat, but you should eat less meat. And I think that narrative is something that I hope we see brands promoting as well, like, buy less, better stuff. Because right now we're in a world where the patterns of consumption are just totally out of line with the long-term, like, effects on the planet. So I think it starts with like the consumer behavior.
And we know, right, that it's never been as easy as it is today to launch a brand. And I mean launch, not grow. So you really don't need, in the same way as before, like big budgets to start anything. So we know there will be more. And we also know that it'll be harder to be discovered. So if both, I mean, what you guys are doing is kind of helping people to pick the best materials to go. So my task is maybe not as important, but just to help consumers that find this value to navigate through the right brands that are doing the right thing. So that's definitely something that is incredibly important to me.
Cool. So if people want to find out more about everything that you're doing with Think Testing, I think just going to Think Testing, by the way, I love the name. It's very up our alley. Like, it's just very simple. So Instagram.com/thinktesting is kind of the main place, but you've been also doing a newsletter that just started up recently, and you've got thinktesting.com with some web-based reviews. Is there anything else you want to point people to?
I think that's it for now. If there's anyone who is really, really interested in also becoming a Think Tester, they can DM me. That's the fastest way to reach me. But otherwise, I mean, that's it. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I really, really enjoyed chatting with you.
Can I be a Think Tester? What do I have to do to become a Think Tester?
I mean, we can definitely continue that chat. I have a bunch of products that, as I said, guys products that need need a proper tester. So let's chat about that, Stefan. But
okay, cool.
I really enjoyed being on the show. I look forward to hearing a bunch of other amazing episodes that you're doing with these founders that I so love to be surrounded by. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. And it feels like it's just, it's still the beginning. So if you're one of those people who likes to be there early on, I would highly recommend following Jenny and keeping an eye on all these great products that you're reviewing almost every day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.